The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is Monday, March 26, 2007. The record should reflect that a quorum is present. Senator Huggins is here, Senator Terrio is here, Senator Wilikowski, my friend Senator French, myself Senator French. The first matter up today is SB 112. I'm the sponsor. I'm going to read the sponsor statement into the record, and then we have a couple folks online to testify, one of whom has a fairly significant time constraint. So with the indulgence of the committee, we'll go to testimony, and if you can hold your questions for a little bit later, I would appreciate it. Thank you. So SB 112 creates a one-year period in which a civil action may be brought against felony sexual assault and sex abuse cases that are currently time-barred by Alaska statute of limitations laws. Alaska law was amended in 2001 to remove the statute of limitations for all felony sex assault and sex abuse cases. Unfortunately, with this change, one class of victims remains left out, those who were assaulted while the old statute of limitations was in effect. SB 112 cures this injustice by allowing victims with legitimate claims the opportunity to have their day in court. Experts have found there are several reasons that a victim, especially a child, will not report sexual abuse right away. Numerous studies have shown it can take years for a victim to fully realize that they were abused and to understand the effect the abuse has had on their life. Sex abuse and sex assault is illegal, regardless of the reason it was not disclosed. SB 112 allows past victims the same rights they would have under today's laws, the right to file suit against their perpetrators no matter when the abuse occurred. And online we have a person who can help shed some light on the reasons for delay and the reasons that many victims have difficulties in coming forward, and that's Dr. David Spurbeck. Dr. Spurbeck, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
If you would go ahead, sir, put yourself on the record, introduce yourself to the committee, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Senator. This is David Spurbeck. I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist. For 23 years, I was the forensic psychologist for the state of Alaska in all criminal matters, appointed by the court to conduct psychological evaluations of criminals in the criminal justice system. I'm also a pediatric neuropsychologist, and I have my offices at the North Star Hospital, which is a children and adolescent hospital. This hospital admits several thousand children a year, and I would say at least 10% of these children are sexual abuse victims. And these, I just want to say from my perspective, having practiced in Anchorage for 25 years and seeing folks from all over this state, that the cost of sexual abuse of children is astronomical, both in personal, in the personal arena, but also in the financial arena. The financial costs to the state of Alaska are extraordinary. The cost of providing treatment to these children. Child sexual abuse victims have much higher rates of drug abuse, pelvic pain, anxiety, and psychiatric disorders, high-risk behaviors. They have more medical diagnoses than other children. They have more depression, post-traumatic stress. But also, personally, they are less involved in school, in their family, in their community, or with their peers. I'm in favor of this bill sponsored by Senator French because it will provide these children and other assault victims the opportunity to pursue accountability from the molesters, sexual assaulters, and perpetrators themselves, rather than shifting that cost, as is usually the case, onto the state of Alaska. Opening of the courthouse doors to this this class of victims, I think, is very important. It's demonstrated in the past that holding these sexual perpetrators accountable and the agencies that hire them accountable is an important way of warning, notifying the community of who these people are. So I think it's very important to sort of level the playing field and permit this small group of victims who don't have this kind of access to civil action, some kind of access, and this would remedy that problem. These older crimes can be solved. They must be solved. And opening up this this class of victims to this this form of remedy, I think it's very important. So that was the primary point I wanted to make. If I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do so.
Dr. Spurbeck, just by way of a little bit of a background, I'm more familiar with your work as the state psychiatrist, and your work in that area. I would see you in court frequently. I don't want to say debunking, but when someone would assert an insanity defense or some psychological defense, you are frequently brought in to take the other position. Is that about right?
I was the forensic psychologist for the state in all criminal matters, which included the evaluation of insanity cases and insanity defenses. And as you know, in 1984, the state of Alaska essentially did functionally abolish the insanity defense. And I would always be, I have been, a big part of my practice for the last 20 years has been going into court and explaining how the law no longer applies in Alaska. So yes, that's a long-winded way of saying yes to your response, your question.
And maybe tell the committee about your qualifications with respect to your job as a pediatric neuropsychiatrist.
Yeah, as a pediatric neuropsychologist, I am in the position of examining and analyzing children between the ages of 4 and 18 who have either neurodevelopmental disorders or chronic psychological psychiatric disorders, which have resulted in severe behavioral or emotional disorders that warrant hospital-level treatment. So these children tend to be out of control and sent to the Anchorage area for clinical stabilization. In the course of examining them, and they're from all over the state, every single town and village is represented as patients who get admitted to North Star Behavior Health Hospital. And I also used to have privileges for many years at API as well. A very predictable percentage of these children are sexual abuse victims. And in the course of examining them for the purposes of evaluating their neuropsychological profile, why we discover that they were, in fact, sexually abused, it is extraordinarily difficult for children to talk about this, especially at certain ages. They don't have a language for how to discuss or talk about or conceptualize what has happened to them, and so they say nothing and may not say anything for years. They may be subject to community ostracization and rejection by talking about having been sexually abused by more powerful persons in their community. So it's something that they are absolutely psychologically incapable of discussing at certain ages. And it's only later, when they get older, that they can talk about it. I mean,
Doctor, could you just hold on? Because I think that's, if I could just interrupt the Senator French, I think that's one of the more difficult things for people that are not involved in this field to understand why anyone would not report horrible and abusive act like a sex assault or sex abuse case. Why would a child or an adult, and let's talk more about children because that's your area of expertise, why would a child not report such an act?
It's very hard for us as adults to understand why a child wouldn't act in their own defense or best interest. But that's because we're looking at that child's psyche as if it was our psyche. They, on the other hand, are looking at a situation where an older person who purportedly may love them as a parent or foster parent or boyfriend of a parent, has a great deal of power and influence in their life, and they're very confused. And when they're confused, they have difficulty expressing themselves. Furthermore, many molesters, sexual perpetrators, use threats. They groom children to believe that they are at fault, the child is at fault. They instill guilt and fear in a child. And guilt and fear are emotions and conditions that we may, as older, more mature adults, be assertive enough to handle. But children are not capable of handling it. They don't have, often they don't have a vocabulary that is competent to express accurately what's going on. So they may not say anything, or they may act out their fear and anxiety rather than speak it out. And that is typically the way that that is expressed in behavioral acting out, which is one of the reasons why we've got to stop sexual abuse in our community. One of the many reasons why, not only is it dehumanizing, but it produces more sexual offenders, because some children who are sexually abused, in order to psychologically control the anger and experience that they had, will turn around and visit the same abuse on someone else in order to prove that they can control what happened to them in the past.
Dr. Spurbeck, thank you. Let me just stop you there and see if other members of the committee have any questions for you.
Certainly.
I don't see any. Thank you. If you have other comments for us, thank you.
That's the majority of what I wanted to say. I appreciate your support. I appreciate you getting out on this issue and helping the residents of Alaska who have been sexually abused.
Dr. Spurbeck, thanks so much for your testimony.
Thank you, Senator. My pleasure.
We have other folks online to testify. Let's go ahead and turn to Helen Andon. Helen, can you hear me?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Go ahead and tell the committee your name, put yourself on the record, who you're affiliated with, if anyone, or if it's just yourself, say yourself, and then we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Helen Andon. I'm with myself. I'm not representing an organization. I was born and raised in a small village on the Yukon River. The oldest girl of, I had eight siblings, two of which were adopted, and plus we had boarding school students, because this was back in the 60s and 70s when a lot of the kids didn't have high schools. So we had a full house. That's my point. And as the oldest girl, I had a lot of responsibilities for five younger ones. So at the age of 12 and 13, I was acting as a surrogate parent, basically. Both of my parents worked, and there was just a lot of responsibility, and I had to take up the slack so that my parents could work. One of my siblings was a little two-year-old that we adopted, and I basically became her mom. I fell in love with her and took care of her while I was home. When I was 12 and 13 years old, we lived right next door to a missionary, and the missionary started to target me. And I don't know where I got the strength from, but I was able to fight him off every time he tried to get physical. And but it took a toll, because I was quite young. And to answer a question that someone had earlier, why don't children say anything? When you consider the social economic status of villages back in the 60s, children were not really protected then, and none of us felt that we had a safe haven or anyone to talk to. And then when you have a missionary who is supposed to be a protector actually being a tormentor, then you're really at a loss. And So anyway, what I did was I had some choices to make, and I left home to go to boarding school because I wanted to be safe, and I figured that was the easiest way to be safe. And unfortunately, like today, I still carry guilt because I left my younger siblings behind. And they were also, I shouldn't speak for them, but they're not on the line. But I left them. And anyway, I didn't talk to anyone about what happened with me. And in many ways, I think I'm one of the lucky ones because I was able to fight him, but I had to fight him for many, many years. And I carried this by myself. I didn't speak of it to anyone. And it wasn't until I was about age 35 that I began to seek counseling, to go talk to women about life issues and to try to have some understanding of why I found things so difficult. And one of those was communication and relationships. It was extremely difficult to speak. I mean, as a teenager, I remember how difficult it was to even say good morning to someone. So anyway, it wasn't until I was about 40 years old that I was talking to one of the former teachers of the boarding school that I went to, and I told him, not in detail, but a little bit about my struggles. And at this time, I knew that the missionary had left Tanana a long time ago, and he was working in Canada. And I said, you need to talk with him because I'm afraid that he's probably hurting other girls. And they didn't want to believe me about that. But anyway, I was 40 before I actually spoke to someone who might have been able to do something about it. And why I'm asking for support of this bill is I'd like an opportunity for legal assistance so that I'm not asking for anything for myself, but I would like to get help for the people in my village, because I know there are a lot of people, and I've spoken to some of them, who have been abused, but they're afraid. They won't say anything. But I think that if someone went into the village and provided workshops, healing workshops for the community, I think that they would go. And I think that this mission, if there were any financial compensation, that it could help the community to heal. And I'm not seeking something just for myself. I think there's been so much trauma in the history of villages that we have to step out and talk about what happened to us so that we can prevent it from happening to other children. I think that things are better in the village. I think that people are willing to start talking about this, but there's still a lot of fear.
Helen, thank you. Was that the end of your statement? I don't mean to cut you off.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any members of the committee have questions for Ms. Anden? I don't see any. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
I also have on the line Sandy Russell from Kotzebue at the Kotzebue LIO. Sandy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Sandy, if you go ahead and put yourself on the record, tell us your name and any affiliation you might have. We'd be happy to hear your testimony. And I should say, just for fairness and everybody, about 5 minutes is what we have for witnesses. So if you can just keep that in mind as you talk to us, that'd be great.
Yes. My name is Sandra Russell. Excuse me.
Go ahead. Are you getting the sound adjusted?
Yes, I was born and raised here in Kotzebue. I am a single mother of three grown boys and one daughter. She's 15 years old. I am 48 years old. I am the middle child of 10 siblings. I was 11 years old when I was raped by the chief of police. And he was also good friends of my parents. And
You know, here is supposed to be this person who is supposed to protect me and uphold the law. And he was also a licensed foster parent for the state of Alaska. And that is why I wanted to come forward and tell what had happened to me as a child. This person will never be charged for the crimes against me. He later became a pastor for the Kotzebue Yearly Meeting, and he was the Kotzebue Yearly Meeting is also known as the Kotzebue Friends Church. He pastored in other villages, and he was blue ticketed from the village of Selwick. He had raped other women in this region. I have gone through my own personal hell, and it's been 37 years since I've even been able to say anything about this, mostly because there is so much shame. So I have really mixed emotions having to live with this. I've had two past attempted suicides. I still have suicidal thoughts. I battled with alcoholism. Now I am into social services, and I help other families that are in need. I would like to see that this bill, I am in support of this bill. You know, there are reasons why many of us have not come forward. And I, you know, it has to do a lot with shame. You feel guilty. You feel dirty. And I think that's why, you know, we never say anything. And we never did say anything. But once I found out that he was a licensed foster parent, that really pissed me off, you know, because I know that he could be molesting other children also. Thank you.
Sandy, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Russell from members of the committee? I don't see any. We have one more person on the line, and I'd like to wrap up that portion of the testimony before we go to folks here in Juneau. I see Nelson Page is on the line. Mr. Page, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
If you go ahead, put yourself on the record, list your affiliation, if any. The committee would be eager to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nelson Page, and I am speaking on my own behalf. I'm an attorney in private practice in Anchorage, and I have had experience working with these kinds of cases and with individuals who have had sexual abuse in their past, and I am speaking in favor of this bill. I think it's a necessary thing to be able to do. I certainly cannot be nearly as eloquent in terms of the issues that make this bill important as the previous speaker. She summarized many of the things that I in my law practice have experienced from the other side as a counselor. On many occasions, I have had the experience of talking with people who have sexual abuse in their past as children, and it takes years for them to be able to come forward. It's simply too difficult many times for them to be able to speak about these things until they've had sometimes decades to be able to process what occurred. And with the statute of limitations, this bill is intended, as I understand it, to fill in a gap in the statute of limitations issues that with respect to bringing these claims, and that gap is simply unconscionable. I will say, as a personal matter, that I have had the experience of trying to pick a jury in a small community in a case involving sexual abuse of a minor, and having to go through no less than 30 jury panelists before I could find a panel that did not have either themselves personal experience with sexual abuse or someone of a close relative who had sexual abuse. This is a pervasive matter. It needs to be dealt with. And when people are finally able to come forward and deal with it and try and get some kind of legal redress, there shouldn't be these kinds of statute of limitations obstacles in their way.
Thank you, Mr. Page. Questions for Mr. Page from members of the committee? I don't see any, sir. Thank you for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you very much.
Turning now to Juneau, we have Dr. Mary Gail Frawley O'Day here with us. Dr. Frawley O'Day, if you'd introduce yourself, please, to the committee, state your affiliation, if any. We'd be eager to hear your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Judiciary Committee, thank you for letting me speak in behalf of Senate Bill 112. My name is Dr. Mary Gail Frawley O'Day. I am a psychologist who has worked clinically with sexual abuse survivors for over 25 years and have taught and written widely on the topic. I was the only psychologist invited to address the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops at their seminal meeting in 2002 in Dallas that was devoted to sexual abuse. Today I'll speak about why sexual abuse victims do not disclose their victimizations earlier in life, what factors encourage them to disclose at some point, and how the window bill will facilitate disclosure. First, some facts and figures. Almost one-third of all women and up to one-fifth of all men were sexually abused before the age of 18. Almost half of sexual abuse is committed by family members. About another half is perpetrated by people known to the victim, known and trusted by the victim, neighbors, teachers, clergy, family, friends. Only about 6% of childhood sexual abuse is perpetrated by strangers. Most victims experience serious sexual abuse, unclothed genital contact like fondling or masturbation by or of the perpetrator. Almost one quarter of victims experience anal or vaginal penetration or oral sex. The long-term and unique impact of sexual abuse has been delineated in 25 years of empirical research. Increasingly, sophisticated brain imaging studies also demonstrate that trauma not only engenders psychological deficits, but also disrupts brain functioning in ways that can be life-lasting. As you have heard and will hear from survivors today, cognition, emotional regulation, self-esteem, the capacity to form healthy relationships, parenting capabilities, all often are significantly harmed by sexual abuse. Over 80% of female prostitutes and male hustlers have histories of sexual abuse. Sexual abuse survivors are 2 to 3 times more likely than non-abused individuals to make at least one serious suicide attempt. Sometimes they die. In 2002, in fact, William Cardinal Keeler, Cardinal Archbishop of Baltimore, equated sexual abuse with murder and called it evil above all else. Surely it is soul murder. So why don't victims disclose? Secrecy is the cornerstone of sexual abuse and is imposed or elicited by perpetrators in many ways. First, abusers may directly threaten victims. Danny, for example, was sexually abused by his foster mother, who said, "If you tell even one person that you have sex with me, I will tell your younger brother that you raped me, I will get rid of you, and he will become my lover." Danny felt that he was his brother's protector and would never put the younger boy in jeopardy. Further, the foster mother's threat that Danny would be sent away threatened separation from his little brother, the person he loved most in the world. Danny's secrecy was assured. Second, sexual abuse survivors may be afraid, often accurately, that no one will believe them if they tell about the abuse. Denial is the most common first reaction to disclosure of sexual abuse. It can be in some ways adaptive, therefore, for victims and survivors to preserve the fantasy that if they did tell someone, they would be believed and helped, instead of risking rejection by disclosing to someone who may disbelieve or even scorn them and sometimes re-abuse them. Third, victims often care for their abusers. Knowing or sensing that harm could come to the perpetrator if the abuse is disclosed, the victim remains silent, hoping that eventually the abuser will heal and stop the sexual victimizations. Fourth, the abuser may also provide for the sexually abused child or adolescent in meaningful ways that make disclosure seem disloyal. An abusive teacher, for example, may also be the only adult from whom the child receives time, interest, and affection. Perpetrators are adept at choosing victims who are needy and therefore likely to respond to the caretaking the abuser provides, albeit at a terrible cost. Fifth, Some perpetrators provide concrete emotional bribes, like money, vacations, or activities that cause the young person to feel dirty, complicit in the abuse, and too ashamed to tell. One survivor was abused by a Catholic priest who took him to hockey games and brought him on beach vacations, where the days were filled with fishing, swimming, and surfing. At night, the boy gritted his teeth while the priest anally penetrated him. This man told no one about the abuse until he read in the paper that the priest denied allegations made against him by several men who had been altar boys in another parish. Only then did he come forward to support the other victims. Sixth, survivors do not disclose because they feel responsible for their abuse and are filled with self-loathing, guilt, and shame. Seventh, disclosure is delayed because often survivors successfully compartmentalize their experiences. They literally turn their mind's eye away from the abuse so that some aspect of self continues to grow and develop, with the abuse split off from everyday consciousness. Only later in life do they realize something is wrong, perhaps when their lives seem less functional than those of their peers. And finally, when the sexual abuser is affiliated with an organization like a religious denomination, government agency, or school, the victim may fear the power of the institution to retaliate against the victim or his family. The abuser, in fact, may tell the victim that if he or she tells, the church, police, or school authorities will make sure that the young person's parents lose jobs or standing in the community. So if sexual abuse survivors do not disclose their victimizations for years and years, what finally gets them to tell their secrets? First, their lives may be sufficiently unworkable that survivors seek therapy or some other form of counseling. It may be longer still before survivors link their symptoms and problems with the sexual abuse, and often even longer before they can contemplate telling families or friends what happened to them. It is a difficult decision to risk attachment relationships by identifying someone in the family or community as a sexual abuser. People often respond by supporting the perpetrator rather than the victim. When Elizabeth Everts and the Hansen family of Phoenix went to court over Father Mark Lehman's molestations of their daughters, both families had their tires slashed and received death threats. Survivors understandably hesitate to disclose their abuse widely when they face such scorn and ridicule and when there is no hope of bringing accountability to the perpetrator. The window bill gives a survivor motivation to take this risk. Second, the yearning survivors have to protect others or to provide support for other victims of their perpetrator cannot be underestimated. One survivor, for example, confronted her mother and father about the incest her father perpetrated on her between ages 5 and 13, only when a baby girl was born to her brother and his wife, and the survivor's father, the perpetrator, was designated as a child care resource. The victim of priest abuse mentioned above came forward only to support other victims who had already done so. The window bill, by allowing survivors to hold their perpetrators accountable, is crucial in empowering survivors to use their voices and expend their energies to help others by publicly identifying a sexual predator. Representatives from various organizations will speak in opposition to this bill. It is important to remember, however, that not even half of all abusers perpetrate through their association with a school, church, daycare, or social organization. This bill is for every survivor of sexual abuse. In fact, I hope that if the bill passes, the legislature will remind the media and the public that the victims of parents, grandparents, siblings, neighbors, friends of the family now have an opportunity to protect and to validate others by identifying individuals who sexually abuse them. Organizations who have adequately responded to sexual abusers in their midst have no reason to speak against this bill, and in fact should support it given its potential to help heal sexual abuse survivors while protecting potential victims. I ask that you pass this legislation and would be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Questions from members of the committee for Dr. Frawley O'Day. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Dr. Frawley. And maybe this was already discussed, how many other states, I've always thought that this should be the law, and certainly we don't have a statute of limitations for murder, and to me, when you called it a soul murder, that's exactly what I think it is. So, and it's always seemed completely logical to me that if you are a victim of sexual abuse, that there are going to be many barriers for why you may not bring that forward within a certain time period. That said, how many other jurisdictions have adopted this type of legislation?
You know, to be honest, I'm not sure. I know California had a one-year window, and I think Joelle is going to address what that precipitated. And I believe that Maine is considering that now.
I actually,
do you know?
My understanding is that California passed a window bill like this in 2000, and that Wisconsin, District of Columbia, Illinois, Delaware, Idaho, Maine, Pennsylvania, and Ohio are all working on bills like this one. So that's my understanding, and we may hear from someone else who knows more about that.
Okay.
Other questions for the doctor while we have her here? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Frawley, that you equated to murder. What do you make any punishment corollaries with murder?
Well, you know, I think that what's often horrifying is that when sexual perpetrators are caught, and the minority, the vast minority of perpetrators are the ones that are caught for all the reasons that we just discussed. But so often they get very light sentences, and I don't understand that. I think that they should have very long sentences because, in addition to the devastation of the crime they commit, we know that for the most part this is a population that has extremely high recidivism rates. These men, for the most part, and it is mostly men, although women do abuse, for the most part cannot be cured. They cannot stop their behavior. They do not have remorse for their behavior. And if they are allowed out into the public space, they will commit these crimes again. And I think another thing that this window bill allows people to do is identify these people. So even if it's past the time for criminal prosecution, people can know their names and know if they're living around the corner or working in a daycare center, as happens.
And just a point of clarification, if I could, just a point of clarification for folks who are listening and the difference between this bill and a criminal statute. The criminal statutes were modified at one point to make to remove the statute of limitations going forward for criminal prosecutions of sex assault, sex abuse of a minor. You can't do that retrospectively.
Right.
You can't go back and say now we're changing the statute of limitations for a crime in the past. That's ex post facto problems. But you probably can do it for a statute like this, which is about suing for money. But there are constitutional issues. That should be the committee should know that, you know, there will certainly be a constitutional challenge to this as an ex post facto issue. I believe it will survive that challenge, but it's an issue because it's not like a crime where you put someone in jail. It's about suing somebody for, mm-hmm, for money,
right,
damages.
But the name can still be then more public than...
Absolutely. Your point's well taken. And Senator Huggins, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just want to get that on the table before you ask your next question. Thank you for allowing me to jump in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up in that respect, and you mentioned recidivism. As I recall, some states now are retaining people in custody after their normal release date. Would you give us a quick burst on your thoughts on that?
Okay, I'm going to talk as a clinician, not as a lawyer or a constitutional scholar. I think that it's crucial that there be some way of tracking these people once they are released from prison, if they even go to prison. So often they get suspended sentences, and I think having them on record as sexual offenders, and having some kind of, whether it's a bracelet system or whatever, is important because, again, for the most part, these guys will do it again. They'll do it again.
Thank you. And one additional follow-up. And the we have been using, I think we begin now, the use of lie detector process on sexual offenders. Any words you might have on that from a clinician?
Yeah, the only thing that I have to say about that was an extremely interesting study that was done in Oregon, where the U.S. attorney, I think it was, or the district attorney, I'm not sure which, and a research team worked out some kind of agreement whereby acknowledged or sexual offenders who were found guilty would participate in an interview a polygraphed interview, and that was subsequent to the interview they had given as, in a clinical setting. And there was something about if they divulged new crimes, they wouldn't be prosecuted as long as they met certain criteria. But I think what was important about the study was that under polygraph, whereas, and this was done with three core cohorts of perpetrators over the course of 15 years at three different points in time, and when they in under clinical interview, the perpetrators acknowledged having one to two victims each. Under polygraph, that number went up to 11 on average. They also, under clinical interviews, said that they had only abused girls. When they were polygraphed, they acknowledged that almost all of them had abused boys as well, which I think we really need to think about. And then what was very interesting to me is that under clinical interview, 65% said that they had been abused themselves as children, which is the clinical lore that about 60% of all offenders were themselves abused. Interestingly, under polygraph, that went down to about 30%. And my feeling about that is these are people who know how to get people to have sympathy for them. And they know they're going to get a better deal if they're looked at as victims who then perpetrated themselves than if they weren't victims themselves. So I think they're skilled at eliciting empathy, and it may be that in fact that the clinical number is too high.
Thank you.
Very interesting. Thank you, Senator Huggins. Senator Terrio, question? Sorry, I thought you raised your hand. Doctor, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank
I appreciate
you
your testimony. Next up we have Joelle Castix.
Yes.
If you'd put yourself on the record, list your affiliation, if any, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Joelle Castex. I'm 36 years old, and I currently live in Newport Beach, California. I'm the Southwest Regional Director of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Why am I here? I'm here today.
Would you call it SNAP?
SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by
okay,
Priests.
Thanks.
And I'm here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 112. I'm here because I'm an accidental pioneer. I'm an example of why Senate Bill 112 and its civil window are essential to the safety of children in Alaska. I'm here to tell you about how the California civil window has saved thousands of children from abuse, exposed predators across the state, many of whom are still abusing, helped law enforcement put predators behind bars, and helped hundreds of children who, like myself, were abused and discarded before we were given our day in court to prove our cases. I'm also here because I can answer specific questions you might have about how a law like Senate Bill 112 is really working to protect children, and how a civil window is the only way that many serial molesters in Alaska can be exposed, and how Alaska's children can be safer right now. By the way, as a side note, the U.S. Federal Court in San Diego did find that the law was constitutional, and I can provide members of the committee with that decision. Because I was able to sue the Diocese of Orange and my abuser through our one-year civil window, I was not only able to expose Dr. Thomas Hodgman, the man who abused me, but I was able to get a hold of documents that proved he was a molester, documents that the diocese kept hidden from me for 17 years while they told me that the abuse never took place. I was able to take those documents and alert the community that they were harboring a molester and a criminal who was given a free pass by the Catholic Church. Without the tried and true legal system, I never would have been able to expose him and never would have been able to keep other girls from experiencing what I went through. Let me just tell you about two cases in California that are examples of the utter importance of Senate Bill 112, the Michaels. Former priests Michael Baker and Michael Wempe are two of the worst pedophiles in California. In fact, their names might be familiar to you because Cardinal Roger Mahoney fought all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to keep their personnel files secret, even after Mahoney acknowledged that he knew Baker was abusing kids. Both men escaped criminal prosecution because their victims were abused too long ago, and as other people today will tell you, it takes many, many years for victims to come forward and report the crimes. But because of the civil window, victims of both of these men were able to pursue their cases in civil court. And something interesting happened. Younger victims, victims who never would have had the courage to come forward before, reported their current abuse to law enforcement. They also had evidence that led to the arrests of both of these men. Solid evidence. And now both of these men are behind bars, and that never would have happened without the civil window. Without the civil suits, these men never would have been exposed. If their victims named them publicly, without the backing of the courts, the abusers could have sued them for slander. The media would have ignored the claims, and more kids could have been hurt and forced to suffer in silence. The Michaels are only two of the many perpetrators exposed in our civil window who are now being pursued by law enforcement. And again, survivors like me became accidental pioneers. For the first time, we were able to use the legal system to make sure that what happened to us never happens to another child. Let me tell you a little bit about my story. Like many of the survivors you have heard from and will hear from today, I was a vulnerable child. I came from an alcoholic home and suffered from severe emotional disturbances because of the home life I had to endure. My high school and my church were my sanctuaries. I attended Modern Day High School, a diocesan high school in Santa Ana, California. What my parents and I didn't know at the time was that the school was a den of sexual abuse. 11 men at my high school, including the principal, a vice principal, two choir directors, and a cross-country coach were credibly accused and or sued for abuse. Documents were released for all of them as a result of this civil window. Because of the civil window, we learned through court documents that the abuse was 100 times worse than anyone had known, and the victims were vindicated. We were able to warn children and parents and communities about the dangers that these men posed. I was molested over a two-year period by choir director Thomas Hodgman. This was between the years of 1986 and 1988, from when I was 15 until I was 17 years old. He told me and threatened me that if I told anyone that he would kill me, and he told me that no one would believe me. So I went to school officials, and they did nothing. They purposely operated to keep things quiet until both my criminal and civil statutes had run out. I had no idea that Dr. Hodgman was also molesting my friend Kristen. I've always blamed myself for what he did to her, because maybe if I had done something different, she wouldn't have been hurt. Right before my high school graduation, I found out I was pregnant. If you're Catholic, you understand my pain. I had nowhere to go and nowhere to turn. So using a fake name, I walked to an abortion clinic alone and ended that pregnancy. It was the single hardest decision of my life, and it affects me every day. After the procedure, a nurse told me that I had a sexually transmitted disease, vaginal warts, that could lead to cervical cancer and sterility. I suffered endlessly for the next 10 years. I watched my mother kill herself with alcohol over the pain and shame of what happened to me. I lost all of my friends from high school. I trusted no one. I suffered from bad relationships, intimacy issues, suicidal thoughts, and an overwhelming shame. I hated who I was, and it seemed that there was no solution and no way out. I finally decided that I had no choice but to heal or to die. I decided to heal, despite the people who had hurt and abandoned me. And I'm one of the lucky ones. But my story doesn't end there. In 2001, I contacted the Diocese of Orange, volunteering to help the church correctly address the sexual abuse crisis. There was an opportunity for me, I was told. I could serve on the Diocese Lay Review Board. I could help the bishop and show the county that there was no other abuse in the Diocese of Orange. And I seized that opportunity. I honestly thought that I could make a difference. During the 6 months I was on the committee, we did not review a single case. We were told to ignore press reports. There were no notes taken during meetings. We had no administrative support. Instead, we sat around a table and discussed how horrible the clergy abuse scandal was for priests. We were a puppet, with no power, no credibility, and no means to protect children. And that was how the diocese wanted it. I was disgusted. That was not a place that embraced truth. I was tired of people lying to me. So I had no other choice. After 6 months of frustration, I stepped down from the committee and filed a lawsuit through our one-year civil window. I knew that the truth would not come out unless the diocese was forced to tell the truth, forced by the law. Someone needed to be responsible for the children because the church was not. After 2 years of mediation, re-victimization, stalling, and mudslinging, 87 cases against the Diocese of Orange were settled. But the money was simply a slap on the wrist. The diocese was debt-free after settling for $100 million, less than a year after the settlements. The true punishment and the true justice lay in the files. In May 2005, most of the documents pertaining to the civil cases in Orange were released to the public, and the furor was overwhelming. Not only did documents show that the church knew about abuse, but they showed that church officials didn't care. Priests, clergy, and employees were transferred, asked to resign, and quietly hidden. An entire generation of children was destroyed to protect a few men from scandal. Suddenly, no one cared about money. People learned why I sued. I sued for truth. No one can call me a liar anymore, and no one can tell me it was my fault. And most importantly, California's children will be safer because we expose the predators who were allowed to go free to abuse and rape and destroy. The most important part for me is girls will now be safer from Thomas Hodgman. The church didn't care enough to protect them, but I did. And I did it through a law like Senate Bill 112. But let's get back to the immediate danger here in Alaska. The files for my case had quite a few interesting documents, documents that never would have been exposed unless we had the one-year window. I know that similar documents exist here in Alaska. There was the signed confession where Hodgman admits to raping me and my friend Kristen. It's also signed by the high school principal who never called the police. There is the backdated document signed by the vice principal and Hodgman that says that she knew about the abuse a year earlier and did nothing. There is a letter written by another principal, John Willing, the superintendent of schools. I'm more than happy to share it with the committee, but in the letter, after stating the brief facts about my case, says to Sister Celine Layden, there's never a dull moment at the corner of Bristol and Edinger. That's the location of the school. There's no compassion there. Only the truth will protect children. The Diocese of Orange didn't care enough to protect me, my friend Kristen, or the children of California from a child molester. The church in Alaska, with its opposition to this bill, probably doesn't care enough either. But Senate Bill 112 and its one-year window does. We were able to expose 150 perpetrators that the church had tried to hide from public disclosure. We exposed rings of pre-shuffling between California, Idaho, Arizona, Alaska, and Oregon. And because we have the files, there are numerous perpetrators who are now under criminal investigation. So let me conclude by restating why Senate Bill 112 is vital and necessary to the state of Alaska. It allows survivors of sexual abuse, all survivors of sexual abuse, and families, communities, religious organizations, and other groups to use the tried and true legal system to expose their predators, predators who may have escaped the criminal statute of limitations, and we can help keep children today safe from abuse. This law will aid law enforcement to prosecute molesters by unearthing hidden victims, evidence, and testimonies, all at no cost to taxpayers. And finally, it will force organizations to beef up their child protection policies to protect themselves from civil litigation. You may hear testimony from other groups who say that this bill unfairly targets them. Let me reply now and tell you that this bill only targets predators and organizations that harbored sexual abusers and those who hurt kids. Victims will still have to meet the burden of proof to file cases, a burden that is even more difficult many years after the abuse occurred and evidence is missing or destroyed and witnesses are dead. I have a husband and a 10-month-old son. My little boy, Nicholas, loves me unconditionally and depends on me every day for everything he needs and rewards me with the most fulfillment I have ever enjoyed. I am no longer the discarded child that church officials threw out with the garbage. I now have a voice, and I will use it to protect kids. I have met Alaska's victims of sexual abuse. I can be for them what they cannot be right now. I can be a voice for them. And now we can make sure that what happened to them and happened to me never happens to another child in Alaska. The power is in your hands. Thank you very much.
Ms. Castix, thank you very much for testifying. Any questions for the witness while she's here? Senator McGuire.
Thank you very much for your testimony and your bravery.
Thank you.
Very emotional. And I'm very proud of you for being a pioneer and bringing up a subject that is so difficult for so many people to talk about, and for you to come forward in the detail that you did is just heartwarming, and I hope I can be so brave most days. And I would appreciate if you'd be willing a copy of your testimony.
Yes, definitely.
To have it in my file.
Yes, and I will also provide the federal court decision upholding the constitutionality of the bill.
That'd be very, very helpful, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Elsie Boudreaux. Ms. Boudreaux, if you'd put your name on the record, give us your affiliation, if any, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me speak today on behalf of Senate Bill 112. My Yupik name is Abuchin, after my maternal grandmother. My English name is Elsie Boudreaux. I am the youngest daughter of the late Edgar and Teresa Francis of St. Mary's, the granddaughter of the late Alfred and Florence Francis of Pilot Station, and the late George and Martha Abugin Peterson of Old Andreevsky. I am married and have a son and a daughter. First of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for introducing this extremely important bill to be considered. I thank you not only as a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, but also as an advocate for those who have not yet come forward, who are unable to speak their truth about a crime committed against them as children, the crime of child sexual abuse. It is with them in mind and in heart that I speak today. It's a meager attempt to make a difference in the life of even just one child. I was 10 years old, with long brown hair that my mom so tightly braided and a blatuk or a scarf. All 85 pounds of me boarded a plane to Nome for the summer where my oldest sister lived at the time. All I knew before that day was life in the village. I thought Nome was a big city then, and when I got there, I wasn't disappointed because I didn't know any differently. We had just gotten television not long before that, so I had little to no knowledge of the outside world. My world was my friends and my family I had known all my life. He was a priest. He was not just any priest. But a family friend and a father figure. He knew my parents, as he spent a significant amount of time in St. Mary's in years prior. I had every reason to trust him. His name was Father Poole, or Jim, as my sister and brother-in-law called him. I remember the very first incident of child sexual abuse, though I didn't know there was such a term at the time or that it was sexual abuse. I'd been playing outside with a couple of friends when we were called into his office by Father Poole. He lined us up against the wall and started asking us questions. I guess when we were done, he said we can leave, but he asked me to stay. I did. He then told me that I was so much more mature than the other girls. And that is when it started. He would have me sit on his lap facing him, and he would kiss me for hours on end, French kissing, my first sexual experience. He would tell me that he was my brother, my father, my friend, and my lover. I have since had memories of more detailed incidents where I know it was too painful for me to remain in my body. I was raped by this priest, this man of God. This plagued my life every summer until I was 19 years old, when I wrote him a letter stating that I did not ever want to be alone with him again. After that, I never was. That is when my healing began, and I put this part of my life behind me, not knowing I had a right to file a suit or file a claim against him or the church, and not knowing that the statute of limitations clock was ticking. In fact, it was only when my daughter turned 10, the same age I was when I was abused, that I could no longer shield it from my consciousness. Oh. Senate Bill 112, if passed, would take into account the nature of sexual abuse and allow for victims to have their day in court. It would recognize the power imbalance between child victims and the adult perpetrators in those institutions that enable such crimes to continue. I was 10. He was in his mid-40s. Many of the victims don't come forward until well into their 30s and 40s or 50s. After filing a civil suit, I have since discovered, to my shock and disbelief, that the church hierarchy knew long before I was even born that Father Poole had quote-unquote problems with young girls and did nothing. Instead, they moved him around to further abuse others. It was only after I filed the claim that he was removed from ministry. Unfortunately, too late for the 5 girls, now women, who have since come forward with their truth after years of silence. And we have pictures here. I'm the one on the left on the small pictures on the chair. And there's another Father Poole victim, the bigger picture there. She was impregnated by Father Poole and told to have an abortion and to blame the pregnancy on her father. She did exactly that. Her father was served, and I mean, he served time in jail. This is not okay. Alaska has the highest rate of child sexual abuse in the nation. That has been a reality far too long. How many of our children are marked with stolen childhoods at the hands of an adult perpetrator? How many more will endure this needless, unnecessary crime before the protections are put in place? Senate Bill 112 is about deferring future wrongdoing. It is about protection of our children and our grandchildren. If only such a law was in place when I was 10. Maybe, just maybe, one of Father Poole's earlier victims would have come forward before I had the words to explain what happened to me. Maybe, just maybe, I would not have endured the abuse I went through. Maybe I would not have suffered from depression like so many victims do. Maybe I would not have had relationship issues or had to deal with feelings of shame, guilt, fear, terror, inferiority. I now work as a victim advocate and have spoken to close to 100 victims of child sexual abuse in Alaska. Many say, I wonder what my life would be like if this didn't happen. What would I be doing instead of drinking my life away to escape the pain? Maybe I'd have gone to college. Many wish the pain of the abuse would just go away, like they have a death wish, but would never take action. Many, unfortunately, have taken action and are no longer with us, are no longer able to speak the truth. Most of the victims I talked to say they have come forward so that no one else will have to go through what they did. Senate Bill 112 is about deferring future wrongdoing. It is about protecting our children. I commend you, Mr. Chair and the committee, for creating an incentive that enables victims to publicly expose the predators, to expose institutions that enable those predators, enforces accountability, and lastly, an incentive that enforces and encourages abuse prevention. Koyana Chaknak, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Boudreau. And if you would let us make a copy of that testimony so that we can make it a part of the record, I would appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Next up, questions from Ms. Boudreau from members of the committee. I don't see any. Thank you very much for coming forward. James Nixick. Mr. Nixick, thanks for coming forward. Please put your name on the record, state your affiliation, if any, and the committee would be happy to hear your testimony.
Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you for this chance for me to speak.
Bring the mic a little closer to you, Mr. Nixick. Thank you. Thank you so much.
My name is James Nixick, Sr., and I come from the village of St. Michael. I was sexually abused by a deacon. I tried telling my father once, and he beat me. He said, "You are lying about a person that works for God. They don't do that." It's hard for me to bring this out because it hurts a lot. I wasn't just beaten, I was whipped. And that's why I couldn't say anything to anybody. The reason why I want to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 112 is to deter future abusers like that. And bring justice to what happened to myself and others in the past. I've heard this before being said to somebody else. If you get the elders in the village to follow you, everybody else will fall behind. You know, Native people are spiritual, and they're very easily converted to religion, whatever religion that comes forward. I was an altar boy for the Catholic Church, and the abuse happened in a church while we were having catechism. The guy would have a signal, you know. In the church, they saw a sign of peace by shaking hand. When this fellow wants to have sex, he'd use a finger and scratch. Nobody could see that. I tried, like I said before, I tried telling my father, but he didn't believe me. And that's the reason why I couldn't say anything. Since I've been wondering why, you know, I had a rage in me. There was a deep rage that came out when I drank, and I'd lash out and hurt someone. That someone was my wife. I didn't understand what that was. I've never had any formal counseling yet. I didn't have anything prepared. I thought I could speak from the heart. This abuse affected me very much. It hurt inside. And being hurt, you know, I abused alcohol a lot to hide that pain and the shame. And because I abused alcohol a lot, I got into trouble, a lot of trouble. I kept on going in and out of jail until I finally saw this ad from Ken Rusa in the Nome Nugget. And when I came forward and told him that I was abused by this deacon, it felt like something was lifted off me. And then understanding started. I started understanding why I felt this rage. It was because I couldn't do anything. I was a small boy, and he was a big man. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't defend myself. And I thought maybe because I felt that way, I started lashing out to people that are closest to me. I didn't understand why I had this rage. You know, my parents, they were very devout Catholics. Very devout. They did not even drink alcohol. I never have seen them drink alcohol in my life. And I thought I would be like them, you know. But because of what happened to me, I abused alcohol and other drugs. I've tried to forgive the church for bringing that person to my village, but I cannot, because I believe that what happened to me as a child changed my life, made me a different person. Sometimes I wish I can be totally different person than who I am today because of that pain inside. I try to be strong and not cry, but being strong is not the answer. Letting out the hurt is the answer. I really hope that Senate Bill 112 passes so that justice can be done, not only for me, but for others. There were many others in my village who were abused by this deacon. Some are still hurting today. Like me, they're hurting too. I can't say anything else. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nixick. You gave a very strong statement. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Nixick from members of the committee? I don't see any. Thank you very much, sir. Thank you for being here today. The last witness we have is Mr. Kelly, Edward Kelly. Mr. Kelly, welcome to the Judiciary Committee. Please have a seat, introduce yourself, give us your affiliation, if any, and the committee would be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Edward Kelly. I'm in support of Bill 112. I feel it's important because I had been abused before, and I've heard it from my mother. She was, she had told me, don't say nothing bad about a priest. I know now that not all priests are good people. You know, I was 29 years old before I realized that self-medication with alcohol was not working. So, and I read in the newspaper that Yukon Delta has the highest sexual abuse, and that's not good to read, because I am a father of six kids, and you know, what are we doing to protect our children? I wouldn't want them to have to resort to alcohol because of something that could happen to them happen. Well, what happened to me could happen to them because I've heard, well, I had wanted to mention that I've heard a lot of truth in the testimonies before me. I recognize a lot of truth. And I'd sure hate to for anybody to try to adjust their life to something they couldn't, didn't know better from. Like I say, I was 29 years old and an alcoholic and had to come face to face with some things, and even then our sexual abuse wasn't something I could deal with then. I would like for, I think this bill would be important for our children's safety and our children's children's safety. It can contribute to their safety. I feel their lives are important. Their lives are important. That's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kelly. Thanks for being here today. That's the last witness we have for Senate Bill 112. I've agreed to hold the bill over because I know there are witnesses, other witnesses who wish to testify on this bill. And since this is the only committee of referral, we're going to make sure we hear from both sides of this bill before it becomes ready for a motion to leave the committee. So we're going to set 112 aside for now, and we'll take it up again next week. I'm sorry, Senator Terrio, please go ahead.
Just on the one committee of referral issue, we do have a fiscal note from the Department of Law, but I'm wondering if we have received one from the court system. It seems like there would be some potential impact or indeterminate impact from the court system. So if we could have the committee staff just inquire about that before the next hearing.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Terrio. Senator McGuire.
On behalf of this committee, I just want to say thank you very much to the victims that came before us today. As I said earlier, it's oftentimes we get busy in our job and we don't realize it's your whole life, and it's the most deep part of your life that you've just revealed to all of us to try to help others, not for your own benefit, but for others. And I just want to say thank you very much, because it's very brave and that it didn't go unnoticed.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. I appreciate you saying something. Thank you very much. So we do have one other bill that we had put on the calendar for today, and that's Senate Bill 84. The bill was held over from the last meeting, if the committee members remember. This is the safe cigarette bill, or the what is the name of the thing? The don't burn cigarettes, or the safety cigarettes.
Self-extinguishing.
Self-extinguishing. Thank you, Senator Huggins. My vice chair comes through with me. And what's that?
Had we adopted O?
Let's go ahead and do that just out of an abundance of caution. If you would move to adopt the O version, Senator Wire.
Mr. Chairman, I move we adopt version O, the CS for Senate Bill number 84 as our working document.
Without objection, the working draft is before us. And the reason it was held over was by, I think, just some of the committee members had a little bit of concern over the explicit references to New York law. One example is on page 6, top of the page, line 4. I know I went back and did a little bit of research into that. I think Senator Wilkowski did as well, even though, at least speaking for myself, even though I have some qualms about that, apparently that's
the norm, if you will. Other states are referencing New York. New York's becoming the de facto leader in this subject, and it's the trade-off or the bargain, if you will, that the states are making with the tobacco industry to have one standard nationwide in the absence of federal action. So those have lowered my concerns to where I'm ready for the bill to move. I don't know if other members have concerns as well. Senator McGuire.
Would you like a motion?
If you would, please.
I move that we move Senate Bill number 84 with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal notes out of the committee.
Is there discussion, debate, or objection? Hearing.
Just a point of discussion, because I did have concerns over the use of the New York statutes, and I was provided with some information that was actually very helpful. And there are currently, I think, 8 other states that explicitly reference the New York fire safety standards for cigarettes. So that gives me some degree of comfort, knowing that this is not something that we're doing alone. I do think weighing our interest, obviously, in protecting the way we craft our laws with the interest of industry to have a consistent standard, I'm willing to pass this bill along. I have no objection.
Without objection, then the bill is moved from committee. If the members would please stay and sign the committee report, we are then adjourned.